That Podcast Thing presents Home Movie Club. Originally recorded April 2017. Episode 4. It's not a musical.
Hello and welcome to Home Movie Club. In this episode, we'll be looking at the 1969 movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Today, as always, I am delighted to say I am joined by Joe Carter.
Yeah, 69.
It's going to be one of those podcasts. Daisy Swaffer.
Hi.
And as always, my lovely wife, Sammy Kelch.
Word.
Right, so yes, today is Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Or as it was originally titled, The Sundance Kid and Butch Cassidy.
Yes, which doesn't really roll off the tongue as much, but that might just be because this is what we know it as.
Yeah.
So I guess, yeah, let's get some opening thoughts. Joe, do you have any opening thoughts?
No.
Nope. Okay, fair enough. Daisy, do you have any opening thoughts?
I was expecting a Western, and it was a Western.
Mission accomplished, then.
I was expecting a musical, and it was not a musical.
Or were you?
Who on earth would think it was a musical?
Oops.
And Sammy, any initial thoughts from yourself?
Babies! I love them so much.
Huh?
There were babies?
Did I miss that?
I believe she means the characters.
The characters are my babies, and they're so pure, and I love them.
An endearing term for the characters. Okay.
They're so pure for murdering, bank robbing, thieving.
The death count was 30.
Oh, wow, you had a death count?
I'm not paying that much attention. I'm the facts and stats person. I know the stuff.
Oh,
that's impressive.
I always come up with
I thought
facts,
it would be more than 30, but...
The actual deaths on screen, 30.
Wow.
That's interesting.
Dave, initial thoughts.
My initial thoughts, as I seem to say with this, with every one of these so far, I thought I'd seen this before, and I had seen this before, but I didn't remember an awful lot of it. However, I did enjoy it. So, yeah, let's get into the meat of it, the plot of the film. Again, it's an interesting film in that there doesn't seem to be a vast amount of plot involved. There's not a lot that actually happens, but what does happen seems to happen over a longish period, and is also, it's an interesting film to watch. Don't get me wrong; it's not one of these where it drags on by any stretch.
Really?
Okay.
Oh.
Someone seems to disagree on that one, then.
Wow.
All right, so let's start off at the start.
It was kind of orangey brown at the start, and I was like, "What? Yeah, what is going on with this film? The whole thing's not going to be." Then they went out, and
oldie
it was coloured,
timey.
So that was confused.
They were making sure we knew it was oldie timey.
I did not remember the oldie timey, like sepia, sort of live action sequence at all.
No,
so that really threw me. I was like, "Is this just a really weird print that we got?" And then it transitions into color. And for some reason, I mean, it was about 15 years ago the last time I saw this film, but I did not remember that at all.
Yeah, so, I was a bit worried the whole thing was going to be in sepia. And I was like, oh, I don't think I can watch this.
I was starting to question my own memories. It was an experience that, yeah.
So, yes, the film starts in sepia tone for what is the opening of the film.
They were playing cards. Someone accused the Sundance Kid of cheating. Butch tries to smooth it over. Sundance Kid is very stubborn and just wants to be invited to stay. Dude is not having any of that until he finds out who it is. And then apparently that makes it okay and he's invited to stay. And then Sundance Kid shoots his gun out of the floor and then shoots the gun over the floor.
So immediately we know that he's the sharpshooter and that they have respect amongst gambling types.
It is a good establishing scene.
Less, possibly less respect, more fear. But
yeah,
so that's the initial film, and that is all in sepia, and for some reason that had completely been blanked from my mind.
Well, I think that's the only bit I actually paid attention to.
Oh dear.
So yeah, this is set in the late 1890s, so coming towards the end of what was seen as the Great Wild West. Oddly, approximately 20 years before the scenes of Red Dead Redemption. So,
yay!
And as we're told, most of what follows is true.
Most of what follows is true, yes.
That was cool. So it's actually based on a true story.
It is based on actual people who actually existed, yes.
The sister of Butch Cassidy was down at the set quite a lot during filming and said that they actually captured, like, Paul Newman and the script were capturing Butch quite well.
Oh,
right.
I mean, I think the reason it's most of this as opposed to all of this is true is simply because actually there aren't any real records of what happened at the end. Although we won't get to that just yet because that is a spoiler.
Mm-hmm.
So yes,
there is an end.
If you're already listening to this, go and watch the movie first.
Yeah, watch it first.
Actually, if this is a fair point. Oh. You probably shouldn't come to this without having seen the movie, because otherwise you'll have no idea what we're talking
about.
Yeah,
it's advisory. On Netflix. This podcast contains spoilers for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid.
Yeah.
So we see that they're called the Hole in the Wall Gang, which to me just made me think, what, do they rob cash machines? I didn't know they had cash machines in the old West.
Well, apparently Hole in the Wall was actually a formation of rocks, so that's what it was called.
Well, they were originally called the Wild Bunch, but there was movie came out just a few months before called The Wild Bunch. And so they thought that might be confusing, let's change it.
Although I think actually the original gang was called the Hole in the Wall Gang. So
they were known by several names, but they were most widely known as the Wild Bunch.
So we meet Butch Cassidy and we meet Sundance Kid in a saloon gambling, and they ride back to their hideout.
And then it goes into colour.
At that point, as soon as you get the large vista of the great outdoors, it does indeed go into colour, which is good, because say a film of that length all in sepia would have been quite painful to modern eyes.
Yep.
Although we generally watch films of that length in black and white and don't think of it, so it's I think it is just a style thing.
Yeah.
I'm cool with sepia.
They go back to meet their gang, but there is trouble at Mill.
Mutiny!
Oh no!
One of the gang members decides that because Butch Cassidy, who is supposedly the leader of the gang, is away so much that actually he wants to take charge.
On the way to the place where they have the gang, though, I quite liked the bit that kind of set up who Butch is, what kind of character he is when he's talking about himself. And he says to Sundance that he's got vision and the rest of the world wears bifocals.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I made a note of that as well. I thought it was a nice line, although I'm not sure bifocals... I guess bifocals must have been available in the 1890s.
But I think
that's... They wouldn't have put that in.
That's quite... definitive of the movie as a whole, though. It's the dialogue that really makes the movie. But that's William Goldman's good at writing dialogue, as we know from Princess Bride.
Yeah, the chemistry between Butch and Sundance was what made the film.
Yeah.
Apparently Paul Newman and Robert Redford hadn't met before this film, so they worked very hard on getting chemistry right. And it did work. It was
that line alone kind of established Butch's character quite nicely, because we'd already had Sundance's character set up in the saloon, so I thought that was
nice. Yes, he is the hotshot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, they go back to the gang hideout, and they are challenged by Harvey. Harvey's a big, muscular guy who, you know, there's no way Butch can beat him in a pure fight. So he, I wouldn't say cheats, but he thinks on his feet.
Mm.
Again, setting up the character as sort of very quick-witted.
Yeah, he wins using his brains instead of his brawn. Well, with a bit of brawn.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With a bit of brawn and kick him in the neck.
Without
any
actual possible fatality injuries, which is good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All fun. The reason that they are talking about mutinying is because Harvey has had the idea of hitting the Pacific Flyer both on the way in and on the way out of its destination. The logic being that they won't expect it both ways, so there's more likely to be money on the way out than there is on the way in. And there should be less defending. This is not how it transpires, but we'll get to that shortly. Yeah, so they have a knife fight where Butch wins without even drawing a knife, and they decide to rob the train. Cue first day shooting action movie, Robert Redford jumping on the top of a train. I'm sure that was loved by the insurance people.
Oh, yeah, he did his own stunts there. Which,
that was pretty iconic.
Yeah,
though.
Paul Newman advised him not to, and he did anyway.
Yeah. They rob the Pacific Flyer. They get away with the cash.
Good old Woodcock, he was there.
Woodcock, yes.
Oh,
the man
I love
who.
Woodcock.
Is that that's the guy guarding the carriage?
Yeah, right? Yeah. Who didn't want to get like blown up or anything, but he was doing his job, and he was gonna do his job, and I liked
it. It was very admirable.
I know, because yeah. Mr. Harriman trusted him to do this job personally.
Exactly,
and he was very, you know, good for
and
you.
And I
buddy.
Was glad that they, you know, after blowing him up, I'm glad that they picked him up and checked that he was alive.
Yep.
Yes, they were very considerate.
Ooh. Yeah.
So they run the train robbery. It succeeds. So they go and celebrate by going and hanging out in a saloon, listening to the local marshal trying to gather up a posse to hunt them down, even though they're within 10 foot of them.
Yeah, that was a little silly.
It was a little silly, but I mean, you know, these people aren't necessarily known on site. It's not the day of the internet. You don't have, you know, instant news going backwards and forwards,
yeah,
so they just...
You can't Google them.
They don't
them.
Have wanted posters?
Well, yes, but they don't necessarily have photography. It's just artists. And in fact, you see a wanted poster when they go on later adventures that is a picture of them, and it could be anybody.
Yeah, like,
realistically.
Like, blurry picture of a white guy isn't really going to make that huge of a difference at this point. There's a lot of white guys around, and they kind of look all, you know, like white guys.
Yeah. In fact, there was an awful lot of white guys and not a lot of anything else, which isn't particularly historically accurate. But
no.
So, yes, they have a celebratory carouse, and then Sundance goes off. There's a slightly uncomfortable scene. But
slightly uncomfortable?
Extremely
uncomfortable.
It would be extremely uncomfortable if you hadn't seen anything of the movie previously. I think the problem.
Yeah, same here.
I'm so sorry, you guys.
I'm so sorry.
I'd forgotten about that bit, and I knew what was going to follow it. And even I was like, this would not pass now.
He was pointing his gun at her and things. That was really not okay. We should
so basically Sundance visits a school mom, and the pretension is that he's going to force himself on her, and he's pointing the gun at her and telling her to take her clothes off. As it transpires, it's his other half.
I think it's more that they're sort of seeing each other. I don't think there's anything formal there.
I don't know. They've been seeing each other. I think they've been seeing each other for a long while as well. I don't think this is a new thing.
Yeah, it's an established relationship in any case.
Yeah,
you know,
she's
and
his partner.
It would have been nice if we knew straight off the bat that it was consensual gunplay, but
basically role play.
Yeah,
and I think that's partly why I said it was less than possibly would be if you'd not seen anything about it. Well, because we actually before we watched the film, we watched the trailers. And it's blatantly obvious from the trailers that she knows these two people very well.
Yeah.
But it had less of an impact for me, I think, because I had seen the trailers and I knew that, you know, the character of Etta was actually, you know, part of the gang sort of thing.
Well, take it from people who hadn't seen the trailers, it was awful.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
No, that's fair enough, and I suspect that was what they were going for.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was sitting there for a good 5 minutes while it was going, well, whatever period of time while it was going on, going... No, not another film like this, please.
It was a very effective bait and switch, I think, in as much as you do, it does scare you into thinking that, oh God, this guy is going to be a nasty piece of work and completely irredeemable and a horrible human being. And then, nah, that's his girlfriend and it's just what they're into.
Speaking personally, for me, he never redeemed himself from that. I could never... like him throughout the film because of that scene.
Wow.
But I think if it wasn't for the gun, I think if he wasn't pointing a gun at her, I would have been able to get past that, but I could not like him.
No, I agree.
The morning after.
Oh yeah, because Paul Newman shows up with the bike.
This was a really confusing scene.
So it was Butch, wasn't it? So it was Sundance that slept with her, and then in the morning Butch came along with the bike, because I kept on getting the two of them mixed up at the beginning.
Yeah.
This is why it's confusing.
Sundance is the one with the mustache, y'all.
I was like, is she with both of them? I was very confused.
Yeah, I was very confused. But then, you had the really odd bike musical scene.
It was jarring. Yes. It just didn't sit with the rest of the film.
There were three areas in the film where there was this sort of musical interlude. There was this one, there was one later on when they were travelling to... Bolivia. I've said it. Spoiler alert. They travel to Bolivia. And then one further on. So yes, there's basically, I believe from what I've seen and what I've heard, there wasn't an awful lot of music in the film that was over dialogue. It was only ever really sort of these musical scenes. So you've got the scene where Paul Newman is around on a push bike with no brakes to... Well, it first seems to be, so he's doing it to impress Etta's character, although it becomes fairly clear that these two are just very good friends.
It's a brand new thrilling invention.
Yeah, no, I agree. This is a new thing, and he learned to ride it very quickly. As someone who takes forever to learn to ride a bike when I was a small child, I was quite impressed with his ability to do stunts on it after less than an hour. Especially as he was drinking the night before.
Well, it just goes to show his prowess as a human being.
Yeah, I hadn't clocked that he'd only just learnt to ride it.
Yeah, it was...
Well, the bike salesman was part of the scene previously when they were trying to raise a posse, and then the bike salesman came up and decided to sell bikes instead, which I kind of like that because that was a little bit cheeky, but... so the bike was literally just invented at that point. Yeah. So yes, Paul Newman has a musical interlude where they have raindrops falling on my head, I think is the song.
Yeah, I'm desperately restraining myself from singing because I love that song. Brokeback Rex, classic.
And I think this is the one scene, or rather the scene in it, that made me think this was more of a musical than it is, because there I've said it, I thought it was
a
musical.
It's a very memorable bit of the movie.
Because it wasn't one of the sort of things where they suddenly burst into song, but it did seem to be something where the music was, it was almost a music video. What was happening in the background was sort of silent movie with this music over the top of it.
And it was like a 70s music video as well. It took me out of the turn of the century into the 1970s.
Yes, there was a lot of contemporary music in that film, and then that sort of was one of them where it was like, yeah, that's...
It was a bit jarring.
Yeah, really
it was.
Jarring.
I think it was.
And the colour and like the softness of the filming and things, it just, the whole look of it was 70s.
I don't totally mind that, though, because I think it's not a film where you see films sometimes where you can tell you're supposed to be wholly immersed in a different time period, but you just can't because, like, I'm sorry, I know this is supposed to be, quote, the 1920s, but everyone's hair is super 80s and it's mega jarring and the makeup's all wrong and that wrecks it for me. But this, with regard to sort of the music and that kind of thing, it feels more like a deliberate decision to do that, to not just use holy period music, and to have this element in it. And I quite liked it, actually. I thought it was neat.
Well, I think the best part of it was when he bicycles backwards into a gate and then gets chased by a raging bull.
A raging bull that apparently in real life was so docile that they had to do something unmentionable to its unmentionables to get it to actually move at all.
Aww. Which it apparently liked.
They had to do that several times to actually make it work.
Yep, and the bull was completely and utterly sort of passive about everything and really didn't care.
But in fairness, I think I'd rather have, you know, sort of a docile bull on set than one that's actually potentially going to kill your talent.
Yes, I think that's why it was sort of shipped in from Hollywood, because it had that temperament. Yeah. So yes, the musical interlude happens, and then they go into their second train robbery. So they're basically robbing the same train
with Woodcock
on the way back, and Woodcock's still on there.
With his arm
slightly
in
worse for wear.
But still resolute.
Yes.
Still very resolute.
Yes, Mr. Harriman entrusted him with this job, and he's going to do it to the very best of his abilities.
He doesn't take sick leave. He's got a job to do, damn it.
Yes, so they open the cart up with a little bit of trickery, and they see that the safe has been reinforced. So they use more dynamite, and in fact they use far too much dynamite, and blow the thing to smithereens. And at this point, no one's actually... It's raining money, which is great, but no one's asking the questions, what happened to Woodcock?
Oh, he got out of the train.
Was he... yes, I actually suppose he was actually taken out of the train, wasn't he?
Yeah, yeah, no one was in the train car when it exploded.
Fair enough. I missed that one slightly.
Yeah, no, Woodcock is alive and well and probably got a promotion from Mr. Harriman.
Woodcock is not in the death count of 30.
Good. That's good to hear. yes, they blow the second... Basically, they blow the entire thing to smithereens. You end up with a situation where you have raining money. And then a second train appears, which obviously is a little unusual.
It's a teeny tiny train.
A little tiny train with a big carriage behind it. And yet they don't think, oh, we should probably get out of here. Let's just continue gathering money. But no, they suddenly, this train pulls up and the back doors of the, well, rather the side doors of the back carriage open and the six horsemen pile out.
Yeah, the six horsemen of the, wait, no, wrong movie.
Not quite sure how they got six horse in there and yeah, so.
Well, I know how they did it in the film.
Well, I know how they did it in real life, but in actually in this, they supposedly had the six people in there and they
really
they all charge out.
It must have been very smelly.
Yes, charge out and start chasing Butch and the gang. Two of the 30 deaths happen as two of the gang get shot by the chasing posse.
No!
Never worked out who those two were. I wasn't sure if they were supposed to be Flat Nose and News or whether they were just red shirts, but
they're not
they
Butch
die.
And Sundance, therefore they're not important.
But they weren't Butch and Sundance, and that's what matters.
Yeah, it was the red shirt cousins.
So they start chasing them across the plains. The gang splits up, but everybody follows Butch and Sundance and ignores the other two. And so what starts what is actually quite a long, possibly overlong chase sequence where they get some very pretty cinematics of the Wild West and, you know, the landscapes of the area as they're just incessantly chased by the posse, and they're trying different things to escape. They get rid of one of the horses, they try and sort of climb and go over rocks and go through water, and nothing seems to be working. Eventually they ride themselves into a corner and find themselves at the top of a tall gorge.
Can I ask a question here?
Yes, of course.
Well, because I can't remember exactly when in this sequence, but they started talking about the people that were following them. And I swear they said Voldemort.
No.
I was convinced the entire movie they were being chased by Voldemort. That's all I heard every time that name was said. And I don't know what it is but that's all I heard.
Was it Joe the Force?
There was an Indian tracker called Lord Baltimore, which is probably who you thought.
That was it. But I kept on hearing Voldemort.
Yeah,
which
and
was hilarious.
The lawman.
That's
Joe,
a very different
Joe LaForge.
Yeah, well, I know that, but once I heard it, I couldn't unhear
but
it.
But one we'll be covering soon.
Mm. Yep.
Shh, spoilers!
Oh, sorry.
And as part of the chase, they make their way and they meet up with an old, I'd say associate's not the word, an old adversary or a friendly adversary called Sheriff Bledsoe, for whom they try and convince that if they join the army, i.e. they go and fight in the wars, then they will get a pardon and so they won't get chased, but they will go and basically go straight and be army people.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, this is never going to happen, so they get rejected and go off further chasing.
Yeah, but they were like, oh, we don't even have to be a lieutenant or a sergeant, you know, we can just be regular army dudes. And it's like, I think you're missing the point here completely.
Yeah, yes, this is a little bit of a fantasy they have. Obviously, they're looking for a way out, and this seems to be the best way, but the sheriff just say that the only way this is going to end is with them dead.
Yeah.
The Bledsoe scene is interesting because Paul Newman was adamant that that should be the last thing before they decide to go down to Bolivia.
Mm.
And yeah. The director did not think that it should be, and they had this just ongoing feud about it throughout a lot of the movie. But of course the director won because it's the director's job.
And I know, having read up some bits, that there is a TV program called Alias Smith and Jones, which was a Western based on the same idea of two outlaws trying to gain clemency by doing jobs and joining the army. So that was spawned from that particular scene with Bledsoe. They end up at the top of this large gorge, and then you get the famous scene of them both jumping into the river and surprisingly not dying.
Oh, I didn't know that was a famous scene.
Possibly not that famous, but fairly famous. I mean, I've seen it out of context where they basically just jump into the water.
Even though Sundance can't swim.
So this, they finally make their escape from the pursuing lawman. And what's the first thing they do once they've made their escape? That's right, they go straight to Etta's house, the house of a known associate.
Yeah, I was really confused. I was like, why did you just spend God knows how many months running away all over the country to then go home?
Yeah, I don't think they were supposedly from, I think it was days rather than months.
Well, it felt like
hours.
Jesus, it did. It was
a fairly long sequence. In fact,
it felt overly long at the time. But yeah, when you're seeing them like later on in the film, then you remember that. You remember how relentlessly they were chased down. How it felt like they were never going to stop being chased, and that had that impact, and it had that right association as a result. But at the time, yeah, it felt overly long.
We paused the movie while we were watching it. It was pretty much 45 minutes in, which was, you know, about 2/3 of the way through this chase scene, and there was still an hour to go, and it was like, it can't please not be another hour of just this relentless chase, because it did seem to be dragging at that point. But yes, they get away, they go back to Etta's place, and they decide that they're never going to be able to run away from these people. They're far too professional, they're far too well trained, they're contracted to chase them until Butch, Cassidy and Sundance Kid are dead. So they do the one thing they think they can do, which is go south of the border and travel to Bolivia. So yes, they go back to Etta's. They decide that the only way out is to travel south of the border.
Before they leave on their deciding to go, what Sundance says to Etta.
Was that the bit where you're 29, you don't have to come with us, but if you do come with us, you have to be quiet?
He doesn't say she's 29, she says that. But yeah, if you come with us, then you have to not whine, basically.
I think I blocked that out because I was just so disgusted.
It was just awful.
It was odd, and it seemed a little bit almost out of place, but...
Really?
Well...
After the other scene?
I guess, I guess it depends on whether you see the other scene as more role-playing than anything else. I don't know.
That's how I read it, because she seems...
Yeah.
Awfully fond of both of these characters, and it doesn't feel forced to me that she does. They just seems like they're all pals.
In real life, she was a prostitute and not a school teacher, so they're very good at faking it.
In real life, she was potentially a prostitute. Okay, we're not
fine.
Sure.
Yeah,
on that
the
one.
Okay, isn't the history of Etta as an actual person quite patchy? There's not a lot that's known about her.
Yeah, I think there's like one photo of her, and that's about it.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, but I think it was that photo that prompted whoever it was that wrote the script or directed to go, "Oh, she's too pretty to be a prostitute. We'll make her a teacher."
Yeah, it was William Goldman who said that the prostitutes or photos of prostitutes he'd seen at the time looked kind of aged and a bit haggard, and that she didn't have that impression at all, so she must have been a teacher.
Okay.
Men. Well, sorry, Dave.
Yeah. No defending that one.
Well, regardless of whatever her vocation was, I think as a mysterious lady, she was quite interesting.
Oh, yeah, she was.
I didn't catch her name in the entire film. I had to look up what her name was after the film finished, because I'd never actually heard her name.
Well, Etta, no, it was said.
I'm sure it was
a
said,
few
but
times,
I
definitely.
Never caught it.
I think that might be because it's not an obvious name.
Yeah, possibly.
So I still, up to the end of the film, did not know what her name was.
So we have this weird interlude thing where they're heading to Bolivia via New York. I was convinced this was the end of the film, and I was really happy because it had been dragging on.
But no.
And then they arrived in a courtyard with chickens, and I got very confused. I was like, what, there's more?
Yes, I believe the whole point being that you can't get south of South America without basically taking a boat, and the only boat was New York. So they traveled to New York and then got a steamship down to Bolivia, and then a train from wherever the steamship drops to wherever they ended up in Bolivia. But yes, so they travel, and this was the slightly weird second musical interlude, where they had lots of shots of the three of them in New York having a gay old time, despite the fact they're on the run from the law and they've got this top lawman chasing them. They seem to spend quite a lot of time waiting, having fun. I know that might be because they were waiting for the ferry, which only went once in a blue moon. I don't know whether that was actually historically accurate or what.
I have not looked up historical ferry schedules. I'm really sorry.
No, and I really wasn't paying attention at this point because I thought it was the end of the movie.
I basically turned off during this whole sequence.
So they make their way through various means of transport down to Bolivia, which was originally described by Butch Cassidy as paradise, where there were sort of easy pickings, both sort of in the thievery and other ways. But actually they get there and the place is, it's a poverty-stricken, backwards
It's rural.
It's Mexico. It's
rural. Actually, when I say backwards, I think that's how it was actually... I felt that's how it was actually sort of shown in the film. And all the police and all the inhabitants of Bolivia were somehow less intelligent and less with it than the Americans were. And they were Americans were out to outwit them really easily, which I think was a little unfair.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'd say I wouldn't be very impressed if I was a Bolivian. Not least with everyone having Mexican accents.
because that wasn't Bolivia. That was indeed shot in Mexico.
Mm. Yeah, and it was really weird because they turned up all in their hoity-toity things, and her with a hat and her hoop skirt, and the look of disgust at the chickens.
Those chickens were. Did you see the baby pigs? Did you see the little piggies?
Adorable.
Can we take a moment to further my dislike of Sundance there? When they've arrived at the farm and Butch says something and he's like, grr, and Butch says something and he's like, grr. And then as soon as Etta starts to say something, Sundance tells her that her job is to shut up because she'd starve without him.
This was not a reconstructed man, was it, in any way, shape, or form?
You see how I never liked him?
Yeah, I totally agree. I didn't like him either. Scene. It was the mustache. It was untrustworthy.
I like the relationship between Butch and Sundance, and I thought the Paul Newman and Robert Redford had a nice repartee, and there were some very witty sort of lines between them. But yes, as an actual person, I mean, neither of these people was supposedly nice people. Butch was supposed to be suave and sophisticated and very charming, but I believe in historical senses, Sundance was always seen as one who was very quick to anger and had a terrible temper and was a dangerous person to be around, which, you know, wasn't particularly played in the film. They could have made him a lot worse, but I think he would have made him a lot less likable in any way, shape, or form.
I read a lot of what he said as banter rather than just being a douchebag.
Yeah, but if it's not funny, then he is just being a douchebag, and that's not banter.
Yeah. No, you were seeing it how they intended it to come across, whereas I was not seeing it like that.
Me either.
They get to Bolivia. They realise that although they want to continue their life of crime, they don't actually have the language skills to speak Spanish enough to actually rob
banks.
That was
pretty funny.
It seems like kind of a major oversight, you guys. Like, okay, I know that... I mean, this is what? This is the turn of the 20th century. Not everyone speaks American, okay?
The way there before they go in. Don't tell me how to rob banks. This is what I do. Go in. Oh, okay. Let's just turn around and go out again.
Yeah. Poor bank teller's like, are you here
to make a deposit?
Would you like to open an account? Hello. How can I help you? And they're like...
I feel like I needed subtitles here because I didn't have a clue what anyone was saying.
See, we had subtitles.
We had subtitles on, and Spanish. It was in Spanish, so it didn't help.
Oh, right. Yeah, okay. So I would have liked English subtitles at this point.
Yeah.
I think the whole point was that you were not supposed to know what they're saying. You're supposed to just get a rough gist, and you're supposed to be in the same boat as Butch and Sundance, in that you blatantly just realise that it's not going to be as easy as you think it does, because you don't speak the language, you don't know enough to actually tell people to do what they need to do whilst you're doing a bank job. So
yeah. Unless you happen to be a Spanish-speaking viewer, it's kind of immersing you in the emotional experience of being someone, you know, who suddenly finds themselves in a place, in a situation where they do not speak the local language.
Yeah.
And how do you cope with that?
But it's fine, because thankfully the lady they brought along with them speaks Spanish. That's a nice plot twist.
Yeah.
So yes, they get taught Spanish by the school teacher. So they get very specific Spanish. So I'm not sure what would happen if they got asked something else.
They'd probably say, put your hands up, get back against the wall.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
They've got guns.
I guess
so
if you're
at
the one
point,
making
it doesn't
the
matter quite so much. As long as they can get across, I'm pointing my gun at you because I want you to give me all of the money in the bank. That's the most important thing. If the person then says, you know, like, I don't know, you know, Julio has
the train station?
Julio has seven apples and wants to go to the library.
They're going to be a bit stuffed at that point. So they begin their life of crime again, and they learn enough Spanish to actually rob banks. And this is the last of the three musical interludes where they
Hang on. They rob a bank in Bolivia and then they get chased. Isn't that right? Or is that, 'cause I really wasn't
No, it's a montage of different robberies.
Even Etta.
Robberies?
Robberies.
Robberies.
Where even Etta is involved in the robbing as well.
Yeah. So, and they have the badaba daba daba da musical piece. I don't know what that's actually called.
Yeah, I just totally blanked that one out. I didn't realize there were three musical interludes. At this point, I'm like, I have no idea what's going on.
I'm really sorry, but everyone I've ever seen this movie with has hated that sequence, and I love it so much.
I mean, musically, it's contemporary, so it feels out of place.
It's very 1969.
Yeah, it does seem slightly odd choice, but it basically just shows them robbing several different banks and just becoming notorious in Bolivia as Las Banditos Yankees.
Yeah, because they were Yankees.
Yeah, that was it. Las Banditos
Yankees.
Because they're
American bandits. So.
And they were a lot more prolific and notorious in Bolivia than they ever were in America.
But again, this is the entire sequence is sort of shown as the Bolivian police being bumbling and
really, I thought they were more on point than the American. They came out the bank and started chasing them, unless I just really wasn't paying attention properly.
I mean, it was slightly, but they were also seen as bumbling. They would run away when someone shot at them, which actually is a sensible thing to do.
That is an extremely sensible thing to do. How is that bumbling? That is a basic sense of self-preservation. I mean, really.
Yeah, I think they were just sort of set up to be the antithesis of the guys hunting them in the first half of the film.
Super posse.
Who were relentless and would not leave them alone.
Lord Voldemort.
Lord Voldemort and co. Yes, riding on their broomsticks.
Yep.
So they are robbing banks and having a gay old time of it. And then at one point, Butch and or Sundance, I can't remember which, sees a man with a white hat, which they assume is Joe LeFours, has chased them south of the border. So they have a crisis of confidence and decide that actually they possibly should stop robbing banks for a while and lay low. So they decide to go straight, or at least suggest trying to go straight. So Butch and Sundance become payroll guards on a...
That's how that bit starts.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they get themselves a job as payroll guards, guarding a shipment of cash from or to the mines for the local mining industry. However, on the way back, they get ambushed.
No. When they get to the bank, they're like, didn't we rob this place?
I liked that, yeah.
Yes, there was the slight inconvenience of turning up a bank to collect some money in a totally legal way and suddenly realize they hit the place back in July. So they're trying to hide.
Yeah.
Hide their faces, which was the most suspicious thing you could possibly do.
Yeah.
So they get the cash. There's, you know, no questions asked. They're following their boss, who is Percy Garris, apparently. Not that Garris, unfortunately.
Aww. Frowny face.
He gets shot, though, and they get attacked by Mexican bandits. So they end up being ambushed and having to shoot their way out of it. They leave the gold or the cash or whatever's in the saddlebags.
Well, and we find out that Butch has never shot anyone before.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That was the revelation. Yeah. So Sundance never swam and Butch never shot, which is just weird.
So they basically, whilst the Mexicans are distracted by counting out the gold, they go back and they basically rob the robbers. But in doing so, they are forced to open fire on the Mexican bandits, killing them all. And he said, yes, this is the point where Butch points out that he has never actually shot anybody before, and he is shown as being quite traumatized by the fact that he has to kill these people.
Yeah, it's surprisingly accurate, though, considering he's never shot anybody.
Well, presumably he's shot at things.
Yes.
I mean, you know, you if you can shoot, you know, sort of a row of cans off of a fence, it's kind of the same principle, just worse.
I got a little bit confused here. Their boss got shot by the banditos, mm-hmm. the other ones, mm-hmm. and then they shot the banditos, but then they left the money? Did the boss die?
The boss died. I believe they took the money. They actually completed the job and took the money back to wherever it was supposed to be going to. So they did actually do their job and were trying to be honest and going straight. But I think the idea was that the fact that Butch had to kill someone really played on his mind. Etta recommends doing other things. I think she said farming or ranching, although they point out ranching is a game for the young. And it becomes clear that in reality, the only thing these two are actually good at is breaking the law.
Yep. Yeah.
It becomes obvious, though, that if they keep on this life, they will die. So Etta decides that she doesn't want any part of it. She leaves them to it. She goes back to America, never to be seen again. We assume she gets back and lives the long and happy life, but who knows? So they do another job. They basically hit a similar sort of situation as they were working legitimately. They hit another payroll for a mine. They go into town with a mule packed with gold. However, the mule is branded, and this brand is noticed by a small boy who runs and tells the local law enforcement. Butch Cassidy and Sundance are sitting talking about things. They get offered some food, but suddenly their table gets shot. I'm not sure what the table's done to deserve that, but there you go.
Poor table.
And then suddenly we're in the middle of a big gunfight, and they are facing off against several Bolivian lawmen.
But was it several, or was it just one? There's one way to find out.
Stick your hat in the air and see how many times it gets shot.
As it turns out, about half a dozen within about a second.
Rest in peace, hat. Yeah. There are 5,000 candles in the wind.
So they realize that they've got little or no ammo and they are outnumbered, so they decide they're going to have to try and shoot their way out. They get trapped in a building. They do running around shooting Sundance, his usual crack shot self. But while this is happening, someone has gone and informed the local garrison, and approximately 30 cavalry people turn up.
I liked it though when they turned up and they were like, well, what are we facing here? And the guy's like, two guys. What? Two guys? Yeah, two guys. Yeah. What?
But it's the Banditos Yankees. And they're like, okay, let's do it. So yes, they end up with a shot where both Butch and Sundance have been injured in the firefight. They crawl into a building for cover. This is where they have the discussion about moving to Australia.
Yes.
Because they speak English there. Although at this point, it's fairly obvious that neither of them is in under any illusion they're getting out of this alive. They've both been shot quite heavily. They load up, get their guns ready, and rush out, all guns blazing, only to be mown down by...
No, we don't see that.
She's right.
We see a freeze frame.
We see a freeze frame.
And we hear the gunfire.
After which they could conceivably have survived, lived happily ever after, gone to Australia, become farmers, and probably, you know, died of exposure in the outback because they didn't bring enough fluids with them, or been bitten by a poisonous spider, like the second they got off of the boat, or
attacked by drop bears.
Or they could have just, you know, retreated into the bush and lived off of, you know, delicious ants and Davidson plums for the rest of their very long lives, happily ever after.
Yes, I think that's exactly what happened.
Yes. Following the freeze frame and the large amount of gunfire, I think the assumption is they both die there. Well, there is story that actually Butch Cassidy did survive and went and lived with his sister for many a years before dying sort of in the early 30s.
Yep,
but there's no proof of this.
There are many conspiracy theories on that front.
Mm.
But I think logically... And realistically, they both met their end at that point.
But their legends live on forever.
But I liked that they didn't actually show us them dying.
Yes, no, again, it just went into a sepia.
Just the other 30
people. Yeah.
Yeah. Went into, well, 28 people. Oh, was those two not classed as the 30?
I'm not sure.
They're not an on-screen death, I suppose, so they probably weren't. I did like that they made great pains in the final shootout to have... The fact that a revolver only holds 6 shots, so you would shoot 6 and then have to reload. And they made a big deal about having to reload right until the very end, where suddenly they had an infinite amount of bullets in their guns.
It was a movie gun!
I believe that was done really because they wanted to keep it realistic, but in the end, it's a movie and you have to have some sort of action. So you save that until the end when, you know, everything's going to hell. And you had to have the fight at the end had to be a little bit more action-packed. So,
well, maybe
the bullet count
went
out the window.
They had multiple guns and they were just dropping them and picking them up. And so
they might have just had buttloads of guns.
Buttloads of guns that they spent the last 10 minutes under fire not using.
Yeah. I think the correct term is butt ton, but yeah.
Butt tons of guns. Yes, that's correct. That's scientifically, you know, a butt ton.
So the idea is that they died at this point, and we get possibly the world's shortest credit sequence, which must have been all of 10
too.
Seconds.
Yeah, I was like, what have they done with the credits? Where are the credits?
Were the credits not at the beginning?
Well, there was more at the beginning, yes. It was one of these films that had an awful lot more at the start than the end. And actually on the DVD we have, there is an alternate cut for the credits. And that is at least 30 seconds long. So even that one isn't very long at all.
But that's something that you used to see in a lot of older movies is that, you know, sort of the end of the film, we don't have this long, like, 12-hour thing that we have now.
Because there weren't as many people working on it.
But you just get, and you know, I guess a lot of the people, like the you know, Best Boy Grip and whatever, just don't get their names in the credits at all.
It's only nowadays where we have the sort of the Marvel end of credit sequence where you actually sit and watch through the entire thing that you realize that it's 8 minutes of credits that is just a bit ridiculous.
I mean, you used to get films that literally the ending title card was just the end, and that was it. That was the movie.
So that was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. I enjoyed it. I thought it dragged a little bit in the middle. The initial chase scene where they were showing that the opposition were relentless, I thought was a little too long. However, I enjoyed the film. There were moments that were a bit icky, but generally, I thought for the age of what it was, it was good. However, how did everybody else feel? I'm going to mix this up a bit. Sammy, you're first.
I still liked it. I still thought it was a great movie. I think, you know, it's got some 1960s pacing, but I'm cool with that because I like a lot of films that came out of the 1960s. I like the musical motifs. I thought they were neat. I thought it made it slightly, you know, interesting. And I liked the characters. I liked these dudes. I liked their lady friend. And I wanted them to live happily ever after.
Daisy?
I liked the dialogue and I liked some of the feel of the film, but for me it never really got away from Western, and I don't like Westerns. And I, having a buddy film where I just don't like one of the two buddies really kind of marred it for me. So nah, it was okay, I think, is my general outcome feeling.
And Joe?
I thought it was very disconnected, shall we say. There were sort of bits of action, and then there were long, drawn-out sequences, and then there was random music interludes with weird, you know, sort of montages, and it just sort of seemed very disjointed and not really very cohesive to me. And I have to say that I thought the bit where they went to Bolivia was the end of the movie. I was very happy about that because it just wasn't grabbing me at all. And then I zoned out most of the end. I think I saw the bit with the hat getting shot and I didn't even realize they died at the end because I'd just given up.
Fair enough. That is a ringing endorsement.
Well, it would be boring if we all agreed. But absolutely, can we watch a good film next time?
No, I think that's fair. We can't all be expected to enjoy the same things, otherwise we'd all be very boring. So yes, that was Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. So next time we'll be watching a movie that I have never seen before, which is The French Connection.
Ooh.
Starring Gene Hackman, I believe.
I'm really looking forward to this because I have a tendency to just forget any kind of media, and I own it on DVD, therefore I like it, and I've forgotten it entirely. So I already know I like it without knowing anything about
anything about it. Okay. So yes, next time, The French Connection. But until then, thank you all for listening. My name is David Callier, and again, I was joined by my co-host, Joe Carter.
I was Joe.
She was indeed. Daisy Swaffer.
Hi, I'm Daisy.
And my lovely wife, Sammy Kelch.
For better or worse, I just gotta be me.
You're probably now as confused as I am, everybody. So at that point, I think we'll leave it. Thank you.
Bye.
And good night.
Thank you for listening to Home Movie Club, part of the That Podcast Thing Network. Find us on Twitter at podcast_thing and on Facebook by searching for That Podcast Thing. Please like and subscribe for news of our future episodes coming soon.